This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guests are the Smothers Brothers, the music and comedy team of Tom and Dick Smothers. Their rise coincided with the folk revival of the 1960s. The Smothers Brothers performed folk music, but their songs were usually interrupted by bouts of sibling rivalry.
None of the kids liked me, and Dickie Smothers had a dog, and I had to play by myself in the backyard. He said, "You got to have a dog, because Mom gave you a dog, and I didn't get a dog. I had
a chicken.
It's no fun playing with a chicken all the time. We didn't even bark. I said, "Bark, chicken, you better bark!"
That was Tom Smothers, the blonde-haired brother who's the guitarist and plays the dimwit. The straight man is Dick Smothers, the dark-haired brother who plays bass. When the Smothers Brothers started performing together, they spoofed the seriousness of folk music.
Many folk songs have been written in the first person, the original authentic folk songs. They have been written during the actual occurrence of a historic event by someone who was involved in this event. The song my brother would like to sing now was written in the first person by a man about 150 years ago. It's entitled Hangman.
Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Hangman, hangman, slack your rope. Slack it for a
short. We have another song, which is an old folk song, and it hasn't been sung enough lately, we feel. It's been sort of neglected, and it's a very nice song, and I know you'll recognize it the moment we start.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care.
Jimmy crack corn and Jimmy crack...
Wait a minute. That's not the way the song goes.
I don't care. I just don't like that song.
The Smothers Brothers became very popular through their records and their TV appearances. In the late 60s, CBS gave them their own Sunday night variety show. The show's topical humor and satire made it the target of network censors who frequently deleted sketches and songs. After several censorship battles, CBS fired the Smothers Brothers and discontinued the series in 1969. Eventually, the Smothers Brothers got a couple of other series, but they never caught on like the other did. The brothers split up in 1976. After 4 years of working independently in theater and film, they reunited as the Smothers Brothers. They now live in California with their partners in a winery. Tommy Smothers told me that he and his brother didn't start out performing folk music.
That kind of edged in on us. When we first started singing in high school, it was barbershop quartets. We were in the choirs together. We had a little band, a dance band. Then we sang the songs of the day, which was something Smith and the Redheads. What was it? Be sure it's true when I say. So we weren't into folk music at all until the folk music started. Then we started, when we see Judy Collins, I remember she would sing every hanging song, you know, every verse.
Minor
every
key.
Every chorus, a lot of minor key songs.
Sad songs.
Don Crawford, a good friend in Denver, did a profound performance of John Henry.
About 12 minutes long.
Yeah, so I would go out there, and for some reason I always would mimic people. And we were known as satirists. I didn't even know what the word was until they said the Smothers Brothers satirized the folk music craze. We were just out there. I'd hear someone sing a song, and they'd be deadly serious about it, and I couldn't help but just kind of poke a little fun at it.
Well, one of the things that you both did were really long-winded introductions to the songs, and I was wondering if you thought it was overly serious of a lot of folk musicians to launch into the historical reasons and the ethnic reasons behind a song that they'd perform.
The long-winded introductions were just the nature of folk music, and I found them very interesting. I never thought they were pompous or anything like that. And to tell a background of how a song just happened when people didn't go around writing them, you know, it was wonderful. Then working with, we got on the tail end of things, Sonny Terry, Brownie, was it Brownie?
Brownie McGee.
Yeah.
Josh White Sr. and Oscar Brand, we did some of his stuff. Some wonderful people out there, and the way the songs came about, the way they were created, to me was very interesting. And then to make fun in a lighthearted way and just have a really ridiculous story that has nothing to do with the music. Like Tommy had...
Dark as a Dungeon?
Dark as a Dungeon. The most ludicrous would be, they call the wind Mariah. He says it's an old Jewish folk song, Machiah. And then Havana Gila, they danced around a hat. It was a rain dance. Actually, they danced around an umbrella, and they, similar to how they danced around hats, the Mexicans, and prayed for hair. And you just the further, the bigger the lie, it just becomes funny.
What's your own ethnic background?
Ethnic?
We have none.
We don't even have a secret.
In search of a background.
We have no food, secret food, family food, handshakes. You know, we're not Jewish, Italian, name it. We're just wasps.
What were your alternatives? Did you have alternative plans if you didn't become performers?
Well, we never knew we were going to, in the long term. Maybe Tommy, he probably feels different. I always thought it was a summer job for about 10 years. I thought it was a summer job. And I never expected at the start to make it a paying profession. It was something to do when we were young and drop out of school a little bit. And we just seemed to get another job, and that was success. So I never planned a year in advance or whatever. I was going to go back to school. In fact, after we worked a year and become teaching major, and I got married, and I was going to, you know, we did our shot, our little fun thing. And if it wasn't for the Limelighters giving us a job at their club in Aspen in 1960, I don't know if we would have tried being a duet.
So, Tom Smothers, what was your alternate plan if...
I had no alternate plan. I still have no alternate plan.
You have to have a plan to have an alternate.
I always wanted to be a comedian. When I first saw George Gobel, who was my first influence, when I was 12, 13, 14, he was doing the Ed Sullivan Show. I thought it was marvelous what this man did. And I'd like to do that. I told my principal. I said, that's what I'd like to do. And so I had a coping problem. I was pretty slow in school. And so I was genuinely trying to get my applause, not through scholastics, but through attention getting. If I was late for class, instead of walking in the back door and sliding into the seat, you know, I walked in the front door and apologized to the teacher and then to each of the students individually until I was sent to the principal's office, really deadpan. I knew I had this kind of a little bit of a gift to get people laughing.
The problem I would expect is if you play a jerk on stage, that off stage people might think that you're dim-witted. Did that ever happen to you, that people would assume, you know, off stage that
I was so
you had
close.
The persona?
I was so close to my onstage, offstage. There was just a very thin line between.
People would come up to you in a Purple Onion, the first job, and say, why, don't do this. This is so painful. If it's so upsetting to you, don't get on that stage.
Well, that's very good performance, because that's like being in really crawling into the skin of the whatever character you choose, and that was the only one I had. And I was walking down the street in the Purple Onion, and some guy says, could you tell me where the Black Cat Cafe is? I said, yeah, it's just down that one street and turn left. He says, I know where it is. I just want to see if you knew how to give directions. You're so stupid on stage.
What about you, Dick Smothers? Did your persona on stage as the just more practical, down-to-earth persona mm-hmm. apply to the role you really played in your relationship with your brother?
Yeah, I think so. That's the way I am in real life, just exaggerated. I think we exaggerate our natural tendencies when we get into comedy. And then it's believable. You know, if you create somebody who's not there, I think you have to be a superior actor to let anybody buy it. I'm pretty logical. Basically, if things don't make any sense to me, I don't want to do it. And that's the way I control our relationship on stage with Tommy. You know, he would go off on a tangent, and I would correct him.
I wouldn't expect a totally honest answer about this, but how do you get along as brothers outside of the
stage?
Why
wouldn't you expect a totally honest answer?
People are never honest about their relationships.
We always are.
My relationships, I have problems. With my brother, I don't.
we're pretty much have been scrappers. We've scrapped since the time I'm 22 months older than Dick, which is contrary to the way a act should be set up.
I should be the older guy with my personality and act, and he should be the younger brother, you know? So it shows we had no plan whatsoever.
And that's the best. Disorganization is a high.
We get along pretty well. Tommy, I get on his nerves at times. He and mine, our friends, and the types of people we hang out with are different. I think we're pretty much like a couple gears in a fine machine, where he has the gear that goes out, and I have the detent. You know, we sort of mesh, and we don't really covet the things that each other have. We appreciate what the other has, and that's as honest as I could ever get, and I believe it. I wouldn't want to be the funny guy. I wouldn't want the pressure. I don't think I have the ability to be funny in very short bursts. you know.
Hysterically funny.
Yeah, but just for very little time. The professional is out there when he's sick and when he's tired, and he's still doing it and pulling it off. Now, the pressure there is enormous, and I don't think people really understand how enormous it is and how it actually becomes more difficult the longer you do it. You could look at comics, comedians as they get older. They generally turn inward. They're not fun at parties. They get suspicious. There's a lot of side effects for being funny, and they're not positive. So I'm very comfortable just being a guy that hangs around, and every once in a while I have the luxury of breaking people up, but not the demand.
You reached even wider audiences than you had just performing when you got on television as the host of your own hour variety show. How did CBS first approach you about that? What did they tell you that they wanted?
Well, a preface to that is that in 1961, we started doing the Jack Parr show, and then we did about 14 shows.
We had 13 the last 6 months Jack was on the air.
So we got a lot of guest spots. It was Bing Crosby and
Sarah. Ed Sullivan. I remember seeing you a lot on the Ed Sullivan
later
show.
Later on, Ed Sullivan. Gary Moore, we were.
So by the time we had our own series offered to us, with CBS, we did a situation comedy that went 32 episodes, which was totally contrary to any of our experience because there was no audience there, and we had to repeat the lines.
It was shot as a film. You know, it wasn't three camera. It was a film.
And it was a very difficult, very trying time for us.
Awful.
And when CBS came to us half a season later, said, "Here's a variety show," I was so upset with the other show. We said, "We want creative control." And they said, "You got it." Well, they were sending us down the tubes anyway. They didn't expect us to make it.
The time slot was at opposite Bonanza. And Gary Moore just got canceled, and he was the last rated show in television. So they gave us the worst spot and then gave us everything that Tommy wanted. Because we weren't going to be around more than a few weeks anyway.
So what'd you ask for?
Asked for creative control. That meant the material, the control
content.
Of the writers, content, the look of the show, everything. And the fact that it really went well. We had a nice cast of people put together by the producers and everything, but it wasn't quite what we wanted, but it evolved, and I got younger writers, got Mason Williams. I'd bring him in. If a writer seemed like it was cliche and was bringing out old material, not creative new ideas, we'd replace him each cycle, each 13-week period, until we had pretty much what I wanted. The times dictated awareness came about that time in the mid-60s when Vietnam, voter registration, Selma, all those things started coming through, and they started leaking into our minds, our own consciousness, and they started coming out a little bit in attitudes in the show. And our writers were young, and we kind of had this little kind of small group that worked late into the night. None of the other shows did. We'd leave at sometimes 1 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night from reworking sketches and stuff. And everybody had love beads on and sandals. It was a real, we were a real product of the times. And we reflected that viewpoint that was not being
So then
heard.
Instantly, once it was a hit, it was a surprise hit. It really was. Nobody predicted it. CBS wanted us to pull back, didn't want any controversy in anything. They, not realizing the content of the show was in large part of its success. So that was a running battle for 72. I think we did 72 episodes. It was pretty much a running battle from day one through the firing at the last.
Well, they actually censored, deleted some of the performance excerpts.
That was their legal right. And once they got it, they, I guess by the contracts and stuff, they could take out anything they wanted. But
how did that work? When would you have to deliver the show to them, so to speak?
Oh, that was another whole thing. It changed. It changed every year. We delivered the shows just a normal practice, but I think the way it was about a week.
A strike happened, musician strike, so that put everything behind, and some of those things. So we were all of a sudden working, taping on a Friday, delivering for a Sunday show. That mean editing with a razor blade, and I, of course, being naive and not knowing anything about television, I involve myself in everything.
Well, wait a minute. Razor blade means that they did not have the electronic sophistication that they have now. So you actually physically took razor blades and cut tapes and put pieces together, and they worked straight through right after production.
Oh, yeah. Wait, great.
And then they gave it to a girl, and she flew to New York and handed them
these
tapes.
Yes, the New York tape. So when they would say, we don't like this part here, we say, you must take that out, or we will take it out. I said, well, I'll take it out. And it did take a long time
Do it. You'd have to put something back in to replace it.
No, if they wanted out. We presented our contractual obligation, which was to present a show of an hour's length or whatever it was, minus the commercials. After that, they could take it out. They took things out and put in a Nixon commercial when it was political. Of course, I got furious.
What had they taken out to put in the Nixon commercial?
I do. It was the whole Belafonte piece, Mama Look a Boo Boo. It was the 68 convention, news footage from Chicago, the bloody riots and everything. And Belafonte sang some calypso numbers to news footage that had been seen on the air. Nothing offensive about it, except where you'd see Mayor Daley in the news footage at the convention, and the lyric might say "Look a Boo Boo," or something like that. It was light satire. They took the whole hunk out. It must have been 5 minutes or more.
No, seven.
7 minutes, and put in a huge Nixon thing, which was a little salt in the wound. But it was gamesmanship, I think, a little bit there.
It was hardball.
One of the most famous deleted portions of your program is Pete Seeger singing Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. Mm-hmm. He made his network comeback, really, on your show, didn't he?
Right. Pete Seeger was blackballed for a long time, and when the Hootenanny show was on the air, that was back in the early 60s, we didn't know anything about what this meant. We didn't know about censorship or there was any problem. And we're doing Hootenanny, and there were some kids out, college students, protesting, you know, picket line out there, because Pete Seeger wasn't on. We're wandering around. We don't know anything about it. And when we had our show, Pete Seeger, of course, is one of the classic people in the United States as far as folk music and his
blues. He's a troubadour. He's a very gentle troubadour.
So when we had an opportunity to put him on the air, we put him on the air, and everybody who was on our show, they were guests. They were considered guests. What would you like to do? What song? He said, I'd like to sing this song, this song. I said, fine. This is too long. We only have this much time. He chose Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and, well, it reflected our attitudes and our staff and our writing staff. And we said, sure, that's fine. And they said, no. So I said, feature our guest. Feel free. He sang the song, and they took it out. Next time we had him on the show, I said, what would you like to sing, Pete? He says, I'd like to sing Waist Deep in the Muddy, Big Muddy. I said, you're our guest, Pete. And so he sang it again. This time they left it in. So what came to us was there was a constant change of values there. And as the public opinion swung both ways during the war, Vietnam War, that there was room for pressing another viewpoint.
So do you remember when that first time that he sang Waist Deep in the Big Muddy was deleted by CBS? What did they put in instead?
We have no idea. Can't have to look at my scripts and find out at that time. We always kind of, we could see it coming. Sometimes the week of the show rehearsal, during the run-through on a Wednesday for a Friday taping, the censors would be running around or broadcast standards would be crazy. So, well, you can't say this. You can't have this. We kind of knew in advance that we were going to have a problem. Sometimes we'd win, sometimes we'd lose.
Would you fight a lot?
Oh, yeah, constantly. One time during summer show, the Glenn Campbell show, I'd play ping pong with the program practices guy, who was very good, nice guy, just following orders. And we'd play for a 2 out of 3 for a particular line or a particular attitude in the show.
That's funny.
But we look back on it now, and it was... It was a social situation that was heading. It came to culmination, of course, but it was interesting.
What did they tell you when they actually canceled the show? Did they come
they
out
didn't
and say?
They fired it. They fired
There's
it.
There's a big difference. Cancellation is a legitimate
termination. It's a legitimate. They picked us up and then they fired us and created litigation and made us unsellable to the other networks also.
So Dickie and I like to say we've had. At that point, we said we've had 20 wonderful years in the business. 20 wonderful. We did have one bad decade, and we call that bad decade. The 70s were tough for us.
Now, they fire you the way they do at athletic teams or anything else. You read about it. You hear someone called me up in New York and from Newsweek and asked me how I like being fired. I wasn't even on the show that week. I was racing cars in Sebring, Florida, and Dan Rowan was replacing me with permission and everything. And I said, I'm not fired. We just got picked up. We're going for another year. And they said, no, you're fired. I said, really? Well, I don't have anything to say about it because it's news to me. I wasn't upset at all. I said, boy, we get a vacation because we'd been working real hard. But that's the way they let things out. Red Skelton has never been legally fired from the network, and he got fired or canceled in 1966.
Well, did you find out about it the same way?
How did you? Did you get a telegram? Or?
I was in San Francisco looking for a place to do the show the following year. I asked CBS not to pick up the option of the following year if there's going to be a problem with the show. And they thought about it, and they said, okay, we're going to pick it up. And so I went up to San Francisco, doing site analysis to put the show in San Francisco and produce it from there. And I got word, my attorney called me and said a telegram had been sent that we had breached contract, and therefore they were firing us and terminating the relationship. And, of course, I got right on. I couldn't believe they were doing it. I got real emotional. I got very involved, lost my sense of humor for about 2-3 years until I saw Jane Fonda one time on television. I said, something's missing in my life. And I watched her, and I said, yes, I know what it is now. It's a sense of humor. That's when I started pulling
it
together.
It's really not fair to pick on her, but she even
admitted she was deadly serious.
She said she was a little shrill in those years.
She would say that.
Yeah, but you have to tend to overreact when you really care about something. Then it was like we look back, we say, you know, we're mellow now. You know, it's 15, 16 years ago. We have the same convictions. We're all more mature. Yeah. We're just mellow, right?
We're still pissed off, but we're cool.
Cool about it.
Are you either of you politically involved in any causes or issues or anything like that? No.
Dickie never was.
No.
One time they said, what do you think about your brother?
He says, hey, Tommy's the kind of guy that goes around trying to save the world. I'm the kind of guy who goes around enjoying the fruits of his labor. Now, there could be a lot of wars over people fighting to save, you know, let me save this. No, I'm going to save it. And they beat each other up. No, but there's got to be a person who said, boy, you did a good job out there. I'm going to send him to South Africa and clean that mess up down there. But we're not political. I think political is the wrong word, social.
Okay.
Dealing with sensitivities and the way people are treated and their potentials in their society. I mean, it encompasses the political aspect. Right. I think we're concerned people, but we're not joiners.
Never were part of organizations. When they stopped saying, when CBS said, you can't say that way, I said, that's the first time someone told me I didn't have the freedom. I was very naive. I had all the idealistic points of view still intact in my mid-20s, late 20s. Mm-hmm. Was very naive, and I took it as gospel truth that you have freedom of speech and the First Amendment, all these things I thought were valid, and reacted that way. So it was a spontaneous reaction. And when they said, Tom, you can't say that, I said, wait a second, where is it? And I started reading NBA code and this FCC and all this stuff. So I got very involved as a lay expert kind of.
Yeah, it seemed to back up your point of view on paper.
So emotionally, I was being stepped on. I think a lot of people become involved in issues and causes, have a personal experience with it, which opens up their consciousness to everybody else's violations also. And that's what happened.
Would you want to try television again?
Of course. We're performers, number one, and we enjoy performing. The hotness of youth is not as powerful and running through our blood now. It does. There's a soft edge that comes to people as they get older. That's why I admire people like Groening and Spock and some of these people who maintain through their declining years that same righteous indignation to unfairness and all those and maintain it because there's an edge that comes to you.
They don't maintain it. They actually make, I think they expand it. You start, it's like the athlete who, when his legs go, he makes up for it with technique and experience. And the brashness that the Smothers Brothers had in the 60s, I think would be replaced with something not of the same nature, but of laterally, maybe even more effective.
And with more finesse. Mm-hmm. And
more subtlety. And maybe
that's part of growing, I guess. Yeah.
The Smothers Brothers split up a few years ago, and you recently rejoined each other and are performing together again. What were the reasons for separating, and what are the reasons now for coming back together?
I touched on a little earlier that after CBS, I really lost a center of... I got mixed up about comedy and social commitment and where humor lay. And even after CBS, we worked for several years. And just realized we were sitting one time up in Lake Tahoe working at Harris, and we were learning a Everly Brothers medley and a medley of songs of Eagles tunes. I think it was about 74, 75. And I just turned to him and said, wait, what are we doing? And by the way, it was very difficult to sing Everly Brothers songs. The range is outrageous. But that's not the point. We're doing a medley of other people's tunes, and I said, let's just wrap this up. I don't feel funny. It's not fun anymore, and let's explore our own potential as Dick Smothers, as you, and as Tom Smothers, and see if we have some kind of gift coming as individuals. And so we wrapped it up, and I tried a couple of films, and Dickie started the winery. I did some plays, and I said, Dickie ought to do a play. So he did a play at Pat Paulson's Playhouse in Michigan. And that eventually led, he's out on, poor Dick, he's out in Seattle doing a...
English bedroom farce, not now darling.
Mismatched, he should never play a victim because it's a contrary to his...
playing a Woody Allen part.
And it was just contrary, and I watched it. I knew he's suffering out there doing this play, and
I got great review in Salt Lake. They thought it was risque. But I had no talent for anything. See, I was a straight man. A straight man without a comedian as a partner is an announcer. And then the winery, and then the play, because I had to do something. And then, lo and behold, the Broadway show came, I Love My Wife, and we had just barely enough experience out on the boards there to say, hey, we could do this.
I think maybe we could.
So the time we didn't work together, we worked constantly together almost. We worked 15 months out of 2 years with that play, for instance.
Not playing brothers, though, which was nice.
Yeah.
And so that was a reason. After coming out of that play, which was about 4 years of doing bits and films and dinner theater and that I Love My Wife, after that was over, our agent said, would you do a benefit for battered children? I said, we don't do the Smothers Brothers. In fact, we symbolically proclaimed we were burning the red jackets in the base.
We wouldn't allow people to call us the Smothers Brothers. It was Tom and Dick Smothers.
Yes, no, the word Smothers Brothers did not exist.
Trick.
No one seemed to care.
We're still Smothers Brothers.
And if we look back on it now, we can see that no matter what we do the rest of our lives, that being the Smothers Brothers is more important and was more significant and will be probably than anything we can do as individuals.
And it's amazing. We're so fortunate in that wherever we go, there's a place in the people's hearts that is very soft and kind to us. And it could be what they were going through in those late 60s and what we represented through their growth period. And maybe being fired and taken away from them was the blessing.
Was a gift in disguise.
We didn't stay till our welcome was unwanted, you know. And somehow it's just out there and it feels good.
That was Dick and Tom Smothers, the Smothers Brothers, my guests on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.